I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. When I was in culinary school, we didn't have many textbooks, per se. I mean, we did have this one enormous 1,000-page cookbook that covered all the basic techniques we were supposed to learn. Funny enough, almost every chef in the school was like, oh, it's wrong about that. Oh, it's wrong about that. But there weren't a whole lot of, you know, go home and read chapter 3 kinds of books. Except for one. That book is On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee. Now, I'm not going to lie, it's not necessarily something you would curl up with before bed. It is full of research about myoglobin and peptide chains. But what McGee's book did for us, and by us, I mean cooks in general, is strip away the idea that cooking is a series of actions you do the way you're told because that's how it's always been done. It opened up the idea that cooking is actually, like everything else, science. It's understandable. It's not magic. If you apply this much heat to this egg, this is what's going to happen. And that knowledge freed generations of chefs to question why they did the things the way they did, and to break the rules once they learned what the rules were. It opened up so much creativity and innovation. Whether or not you cared for what people called molecular gastronomy or not, you can absolutely see the results of that creativity in what people eat every day. If you've heard of reverse searing or sous vide, or if you talk about developing gluten in bread dough, there's a good chance it's because someone read their McGee. And now Harold has a new book about a new passion, scent, smells and how they work, how they appear and how we understand them. And of course, scent is a huge part of flavor. So we were delighted that Harold would join us for the hour. We talked about his beginnings, how food has changed, and what scents can teach us, not just about what's delicious, but about life itself. Hey, Harold, it's great to talk with you.
Hello, Francis.
I knew of your work because I'd read On Food and Cooking, one of your books, in culinary school, to learn about the science of food. And, you know, just as a fan, I remember seeing you in a restaurant in New York City. I didn't come say hi. I didn't want to bother you during your meal, but I remember you sitting at the bar and thinking, oh my God, that's Harold McGee. And then seeing the chef come out and just fall over himself to feed you. And I remember actually seeing that scene a couple times over time. And you were a total superstar. Chefs were turning to your research to help them think about how to rethink cooking. I think a lot of people would call that the molecular gastronomy era, where, you know, chefs were turning liquids into spheres and, you know, they were using tweezers in their cooking and all that stuff. But that book that everyone uses a reference, On Food and Cooking, first came out in 1984, I believe, in the mid-80s.
That's right.
And famously, you worked on it for 10 years. Can you actually take us back to that moment? Like, why did you write that book? And what was the reception at the time in the 80s from the food world?
Well, I started writing about the science of cooking in the late 70s. And I did that because I wasn't able to get a job doing what I really wanted to do.
which was what?
To teach poetry.
Oh, my God.
And I'd had some a fair amount of science in my undergraduate work, and my mentors at the university were helping me, first of all, try to find a job and then think about alternatives, said, you know, you have that science in your background. You should do something with that. And I'd been teaching writing, so I thought, well, you know, maybe I could start practicing what I've been preaching to my students and write about the science of everyday life. That was the idea that occurred to me because I wasn't a specialist in anything in particular. And I had friends in science departments and in the literature departments, and we would sometimes get together for potlucks. And sometimes the only conversational subject we all had in common was the food in front of us and, you know, what people brought to the potlucks. And we were all, you know, beginning to learn about wine for the first time and that kind of thing. And it just occurred to me that there was something interesting there. And a friend of mine from New Orleans at one point asked me why it was that beans made him uncomfortable a few hours after he overindulged in them, because he really loved red beans and rice. I thought that was a fun question. I went to the library and I found an answer. And I thought, okay, there's a subject here that has not been dealt with that perhaps I could deal with. And
Beans and Digestion would have been a much more niche book. I'm glad you brought in beyond that.
Yes. But things like that are great for, you know, leavening a more solid treatment of the subject with a little bit of fun. Anyway, I put together a proposal to write a book about the science of cooking, and a publisher in New York heard about it and asked about it and did me the great favor of suggesting that I not simply make it either a technical manual or a Q&A kind of thing, but to include something of the history, how we came to know what we know about food and cooking. And that gave me license to then go to the Schlesinger Library in Boston and spend hours just pulling books off the shelves back when you could do that, and learning about the history of cooking as well as the science. And it didn't take me 10 years. It took me more like 3 or 4 back then, mainly because there was just not a lot known about the science of cooking. So I didn't have so much to cover. But I did have to do it the old-fashioned way. No computers, electric typewriters, looking up index volumes of journals and libraries, and then going and finding the actual volume on the shelf and opening it up and finding out that there's nothing there worth talking about. So it was kind of tedious.
You're making my eyes twitch right now.
Yeah, no, research has gotten a lot easier since then. But then it came out in 1984, and it was basically ignored. It was not an approach to food and cooking that resonated at the time. Nobody really paid much attention to it until, thank goodness, in 1985, Mimi Sheraton had come across it and devoted a piece in Time magazine to the book and to that way of thinking about food and cooking. And then people began to pay attention. And it ended up being adopted by the culinary schools as a textbook. And that's how it found its way into the mainstream of the culinary world.
Oh, that's so interesting. And what was the reception from the food world? I mean, obviously, if the culinary schools are starting to use it as a textbook, that's, I imagine, you know, personally for you, that felt super gratifying. But were there chefs reaching out to you? Were, you know, was there that kind of interest, or was it just, you know, somewhat more academic still?
It actually took two forms. One was chefs reaching out, and actually students reaching out much more than chefs. So again, this is the early 80s. Most of the chefs with names at the time were European-born, European-trained, and they already knew what they were doing, you know. So they, and I met several of them, and they said, you know, that's an interesting book, but really has nothing to do with my day-to-day work. The students who were learning how all these things work and asking questions, why do it this way and not that way, they're the ones I really heard from the most. So there was that side of it. And then on the more public side, people thought it was funny that science was being applied to cooking. So I was photographed a lot with my nose up against a graduated cylinder or a Bunsen burner, you know, holding some piece of food in my hand, because the juxtaposition of science and cooking in the home seemed so strange at the time.
Yeah. I mean, well, I think, correct me if you feel differently, But in my head, it's because I think as a society, we didn't think that much of food, right? Like, it seemed almost ridiculous that someone would care enough to look at it from the scientific point of view. We didn't value food in that way. Certainly, everyone has always enjoyed eating tasty food. And certainly, there were nice restaurants where you were, you know, you would be classy if you went there, or you would show off your classiness if you're hosting people there. But I think the idea of food as an actual interest wasn't, you know, hadn't taken hold, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's true not just of the science side of things, but I had friends back then, got to know people through a growing network, people who wanted to write about the history of food or the sociology, so many aspects of food that were simply not acceptable in the academy at that time because food was not a respectable subject, period. And so the people who were doing it back then were really fighting against the tide. And I was lucky because you could kind of have fun with what I was doing. Mm. You could, you know, have these odd sorts of photo shoots and so on. But for people who were interested, had an academic interest in food, it was really rough going for a good decade or two.
Yeah. So at some point, you know, getting from the 80s to the period I'm talking about, the mid-2000s? That's like 2500. But anyway, yeah, like 2005, 2006, chefs are calling you, they're consulting with you, they're asking you to come to their conferences. You were like the oracle at Delphi, right, for the chef world. How did that feel?
Well, it felt wonderful, of course, but also just a little bit unearned because in 2004, 2005, the second edition of the book had come out, and that did take 10 years. And it took 10 years partly because I had realized that the subject was important to the profession. And I hadn't realized that the first time around. I thought I was just writing for my friends and, you know, other people who are just curious about the way the world works. When I saw how important it could be for the profession, then for the second edition, I really tried to make it as comprehensive as possible. But I wasn't cooking. You know, I hadn't earned my stripes the hard way in kitchens. And so to be treated so wonderfully and respected so much by a profession where I actually hadn't practiced the profession felt a little jarring, and still does, I have to say.
That's food science writer Harold McGee, author of the classic On Food and Cooking. And his latest is Nosedive. We'll be back with more conversation with Harold in just a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So we're spending this episode with the award-winning and, frankly, culinary world-changing author Harold McGee. He helped a revolution in cooking by unlocking all the mysteries of the scientific hows and whys of whisking, searing, simmering, and all the rest. And he's got a new book, Nosedive, about the science and philosophy of scent. Let's get back to our conversation. So tell us how you decided to, you know, take a not a total 180, but a little bit of a turn into a deep dive into the study of aroma.
Well, back in 2010, I started work on what I thought was a book about flavor, because, you know, I write about food and drink, and for me, flavor is the most fascinating aspect of cooking and enjoying food, and I really wanted to devote a whole book just to that. In the process, I ended up changing the focus for a couple of reasons. One of them was that, of course, flavor is taste plus smell, but taste is a relatively limited sense. Smell is where all the variety of food comes from. So I knew I was going to focus more on smell than on taste. And then once I did that, I began to be struck by the echoes among different aromas of foods. For example, Parmesan cheese smelling like ripe pineapple sometimes. And then by the echoes of the larger world in foods. So wine writers have the most advanced vocabulary for describing aromas, and they talk about, you know, flowery smells in wines. They talk about sweaty saddle smells in wines. Those have nothing to do with fermented grapes, but yet those smells really are there. So that led me to ask the question, what are those smells doing in sweaty saddles or flowers? And that ended up drawing me into this question, why do things in the world in general have the smells that they do? And I took this dive that required 10 years because I knew food and drink, but I didn't know sweaty saddles or flowers. So I had to learn all that stuff. You know, I can find a sweaty saddle here in California, but finding someone who has studied the volatile molecules from a sweaty saddle, that's the real challenge.
May that person exist. As you mentioned, smell is the vast majority of what we think of as flavor. That's really what contributes to flavor. Just as a basic statement, you know, taste, saltiness, sweetness, bitterness, sourness, umami is generally included now. And there are a couple other, like, maybe that's a taste, maybe that's a not kind of things going on. But almost everything else that we perceive as flavor comes from smell. And in the book, you write that smell has long been regarded, you know, in Western philosophy anyway, as, quote, the lowest sense. What does that mean?
Well, it's true in Western traditions that it's been considered, you know, more reflective of our animal nature than of our higher nature. So, you know, we can write, we can communicate with each other with sound. We can think of things that aren't right in front of us and draw pictures of them, or compose music. We can do things with those senses that we don't seem to be able to do with smell, which has more to do with detecting what's around us, not necessarily something that we're actually creating and reflecting our human nature with. Mm. And oftentimes, smell comes down to a matter of nice or not so nice. You know, oftentimes we notice smells when they're disgusting. You know, and they get our attention for that reason. And we don't have the same kind of problems with vision and hearing. So smell just has seemed to be much more grounded in our in physical necessity and therefore not as worthy of attention as sight and hearing.
Oh, that's so interesting. But I love what you say. You write a version of this in the book, and when we were chatting, you said this in this really beautiful way. You said, smell is the bridge between what we put in our bodies and what is in the world around us. And that really reforms the way I think about that sense. What does that idea mean to you?
Well, that's what helped explain for me why it was that I was getting these echoes of the rest of the world in food and drink. You know, we have to breathe many times a minute. Every time we take air in, we're also taking in molecules from the world around us. And if we pay attention to what those molecules are, that is to say, pay attention to the smells we're detecting, then we learn things about the world around us in that way that might not be evident by sight or by hearing. And then when we enjoy food and drink, we're also breathing, but we're breathing out instead of breathing in. And it's that breathing out, that exhalation, that brings molecules from our mouth into contact with our nose to help us confirm and savor what it is that we've taken into our bodies.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think of the fact that smells are physical, right? In the sense that they are actually made of matter. When you smell something, that means that thing is actually inside your body.
And in a way, even more amazing, it actually becomes part of us momentarily, because what happens is that we have receptors in our nose that detect these molecules, and they detect them by binding onto them, by grabbing onto them and holding onto them. And so for that split second, they're actually part of our body as much as the receptor is.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating. There's like so much metaphoric power in there. And I know as a lover of poetry, I'm sure like you totally are so geeked out by that. You have this beautiful metaphor in the book about listening to smells rather than hearing them. Can you explain that to us?
Yes. I learned about this way of experiencing smells when I went to Japan and had the opportunity to experience the incense ceremony that they have there, which is in a way parallel to the tea ceremony, where you really pay attention to the making and the enjoyment of a cup of tea. They do the same kind of thing with incense. They take a little piece of incense wood and they put it by itself on a very carefully constructed little platform that allows the aroma of the incense to predominate, so it's not clouded by the smell of smoke and that kind of thing. And you pay attention to it, you register it, you think of what it smells like, and then you take another piece of incense wood that's different, and you appreciate that, and then appreciate the differences. And the term that the Japanese use is translated into English as listening to smells. And at first I thought that was, an unfortunate necessity. The English language just doesn't have a good word for paying attention to smells. But then I thought it's that incongruity that I think helps enforce the fact that when we smell things, we're usually not really paying attention. And so listening to smells is like listening to a sound instead of hearing it. Hearing is kind of passive and, you know, by the way. Listening, you're paying attention, you're getting information, you're registering it. And we can do the same thing with smells.
Yeah. And what do you find when you sort of practice scent that way?
Well, it depends completely on what it is that I'm paying attention to. But usually what happens is that there's a kind of initial overall impression, which then begins to show different sides of itself, different nuances. And one of the things I try to explain in the book is that even though we think of the smell of incense or the smell of a pine needle or something like that as a smell, in fact, all smells are composites. So they're more like chords in music rather than single notes. There's not a single pine note, but there are a number of notes that together come together in the chord that tells us that we're standing under a pine tree. And the more you focus on a particular smell and stay with it, the more that overall chord begins to fragment a little bit, and you can get a sense for the different components that make it up.
Oh, I love that. So it's like you sort of can dig into it a little bit more and kind of identify it, not just as pine, but what is it about this aroma specifically that makes you not just identify it as pine, but sort of learn and lean into it. It is actually, you know, this is probably literally the same thing we do when I think of really savoring food, right? When you just let yourself focus on what you're chewing, what you're tasting, therefore, to your point, what you're smelling, you're actually giving yourself permission or compelling yourself to really sit and focus on that flavor.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly it. And in fact, what I realized at some point was that I was taking my background in food and that very experience that you're just describing, paying attention to something that's either special because it's been made in a nice restaurant or it's an expensive ingredient or because someone important to you has just made it, or because you're making it for the first time and you want to see whether you got it right. That same kind of attention, savoring, can be applied to everything in the world. You know, we can take that same the same attention that we give to foods that we love and give it to the things around us and get to know them better and kind of bring them into the database of our experiences so that the next time we have that resonance to work with, we have those connections.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. So I also used to teach writing, and there was a student who I really loved who had a lot of crackpot ideas and was a little bit arrogant about them. But but he once said this thing that I'll never forget, and he said that, well, I think writers are better livers of life. Well, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, if you're a writer, that means you're constantly looking at the world around you and you're trying to really freeze the scene. You're trying to really take in the scene, remember the scene, remember the conversation so that you can write them down later. And because you're approaching the world that way, you are quote unquote living life better. You're taking more of it in. So I had lots of problems with how he characterized that. But there is something to that idea, I think, of if you're just opening your mind and opening your senses up to the world and just letting yourself be in a literal way sensitive to what you're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, whatever. And just trying to like sit with them and process them and hold space for them. It really just makes the world that much richer.
Yeah, and one of the things that modern day neuroscience has been kind of developing in spades is how little of the world we're actually aware of at any given moment, how much the brain is screening out of our consciousness because, you know, we're on a mission to make a Zoom call or to get a cup of coffee or whatever it happens to be. We're purposeful, and so the brain tends to screen out anything that's not relevant to our achieving that purpose. So there's okay. just all kinds of stuff going on around us that that we're simply not aware of unless we choose to kind of force our brains to pay attention. And that's, I think, what the incense ceremony, the tea ceremony, and things like that do, is that they kind of restrict all the other things going on in the world, all the distractions, to let you focus on one particular thing and see how much there is in that one particular thing.
Yeah. I love it. I mean, we're talking all of this, and like at the end of the day, there's a very simple cliche for it, which is literally stop and smell the roses, right? Like that's really what we're talking about.
Yeah, I would say though, stop and smell the roses and everything else.
Yeah. Let me get to cooking. You know, there's this pretty compelling theory that cooking food is what makes us human, right? I think you've probably heard this before, the subject of a best-selling book a number of years ago. The idea is that because cooking makes food more digestible, we were able to, you know, access nutrients super efficiently, and then that excess of nutrients allowed our brains to evolve and all that. And while it wouldn't have been obvious to early humans, you do have a thought as to maybe why they were doing it.
Yeah, so I think the cooking hypothesis is a really strong one, and I'm even though there are still some obstacles to really demonstrating it, I think it is the right idea. But you know, an average human being at any given moment is not really aware of the long-term consequences of
sure.
what they're doing at that particular moment, and so it really can't be that a human being around the time that we learned how to control fire would know, okay, let's cook our foods because that way we're going to be better nourished. What would have occurred to them was, wow, this smells amazing. I've never smelled anything like this before. And it didn't even have to be intentional. You know, you kill an animal and you leave it next to the campfire and part of it just gets warm and it's going to smell different. And then if somebody spills a piece into the fire, yeah, it's going to be just an explosion of aroma. So my feeling is that the sensory appeal of cooked foods had to have played a really important role in the initial adoption of of cooking. It just made life much more interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I certainly buy that because I know what cooked meat smells like and how it smells great. But, you know, one thing I've also thought about a lot is how very few things are innately pleasurable and innately, you know, non-pleasurable, right? Like most things we learn to love and appreciate or learn to find disgusting and gross. At least I think that's true. So, sweet things, I've heard babies are naturally attracted to sweet things because sweetness suggests sugar, which says there's calories. And so the body just knows it wants that kind of thing. But although the aromas may have been stronger, it's not clear that they would have necessarily smelled better, right? Like how does that work?
Yeah. So some really interesting experiments have been done with other animals, with primates, with dogs. I'm trying to remember now which other mammals have been used, but experiments have been done to show that if you give an animal a choice between a raw food that it already likes and is willing to eat, mm-hmm. and a cooked version of that same food, they will take the cooked one.
Really?
Yes. So, and I think probably the same would have been true for us back in the day. And I think this is hypothesis, of course, but I think one of the reasons may simply be that the sensory experience of cooked foods is just richer, stronger, if you'd like to use that word, makes more of an impression.
Okay.
And I think, we're animals. We have these senses to be stimulated, you know. They're there for a reason, and oftentimes they're not being stimulated. So if you have the chance to have something that really does, gobsmack you with its flavor, that's going to be interesting, and maybe more interesting than kind of chewing for 20 minutes on one tuber to get it down.
That's Harold McGee, author of the classic Food Science Bible on Food and Cooking, and his new book, Nosedive. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with more with him in just a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending this episode with the food science writer Harold McGee, whose newest book is Nosedive. It's a 10-year project on the science of scent. We've talked about his own beginnings, how he's seen the cooking world change, and we share his fascination with the sense of flavor, why we love some and hate others. Let's get back to our conversation. Why does cooking tend to boost aroma and flavor?
Well, it's because we eat living things for the most part, you know, plant and animal tissues, and they're built up of very large molecules, proteins, carbohydrates, fats, which in and of themselves don't have smells. They're not aromatic because in order for something to have a smell, it has to be a small enough molecule that it can escape whatever it's in and fly through the air and end up being inhaled into our nose.
Okay.
And proteins, carbohydrates, fats, they're just way, way too big. But what cooking does, what fermentation does, is break those large molecules down into smaller ones, small enough sometimes that they're actually small enough to leave the material and fly through the air and into our noses. And so it's that breaking down of the basic materials of the food into smaller molecules that generates that greater flavor.
Oh, interesting. That's so interesting about how raw things don't typically have that much smell. But what about, I think about this summer, it was a great year for peaches. And I just remember coming home and just there being peaches I could smell the moment I walk into the apartment, or melons. Tell us about fruit then. Like, why does fruit tend to have such extraordinarily strong aroma.
Yeah. So fruits are, they're essentially foods that have been cooked up for us by plants. that is to say, they're plant tissues that are designed by the plant to be attractive to animals, so that an animal will come along when the fruit is ripe and take the fruit someplace and eat the fleshy part and leave the seed behind. The seed can then germinate and become a new plant far enough away from the parent that it's not going to be competition. So it's it's an inducement, and it's a signal. You know, an unripe peach has no aroma whatsoever. When the peach is ripe, this whole system goes into overdrive to generate aroma, to push it out into the air. Lots and lots of these small volatile molecules, precisely to get our attention and to get us to eat it and enjoy it.
It's funny too, but then also like seeds themselves have lots of aroma and flavor, and that's not really the part. I know it's tricky to talk about these in these terms because what you're describing, I think, is, you know, a depiction of evolutionary advantage or advantages gained through evolution. But you know, fruits and vegetables and plants, they don't have agency. They didn't decide one day, here's our plan. You know, it happens through natural selection. But it's funny to hear you say that because I think of how I've just been really into eating seeds lately. But like, that's not actually the part that the plant wants me to chew up and like, you know, destroy.
That's right.
Tell us about how seeds and, you know, spices came to have such aromas as well.
Well, actually, let's stay with that peach that you enjoyed so much, because have you ever cracked open the pit of a peach and chewed on the seed inside? What does it taste like?
It's not actually a bitter almond, but it looks and tastes like bitter almond, right?
Yeah. It tastes like almond essence. Most people have never had the chance to taste a true bitter almond, but it's that smell of, you know, the almond essence you can buy in the grocery store and then add to your baked goods and so on. And the reason it's actually that we don't have bitter almonds for the most part, and the reason that people sell that essence is that aroma, the aroma of bitter almond, goes hand in hand in the peach pit with cyanide.
Glad I don't eat it that much.
In the peach pit and in bitter almonds, that aroma, which we find so wonderful and use in all kinds of dishes, is there as a warning signal. You're going to die if you eat this.
Now you tell me.
So that's why we separate the aroma from the cyanide in order to make the essence in the grocery store. So it's true that plants protect their seeds because the seeds are their offspring. You know, they do what they can. But the thing is that we human beings, being as inventive and insatiable as we are, have found ways around those defenses, or have found ways actually to enjoy those, what amounts to chemical weapons, either by separating the smell from the weapon itself, in the case of peaches and almonds, or in the case of spices, we use spices and herbs to add flavor to other foods. We don't eat them whole, just by themselves. And it's an interesting experiment to do, to, you know, take a handful of thyme and put it in your mouth and see what it's like. It's it hurts. But in homeopathic doses in a stew, it does wonderful things by adding a layer of complexity and aroma that wasn't there before. So we've found ways to use these weapons to our advantage and to make eating and drinking more interesting.
Yeah. My wife absolutely despises celery. Why do so many people hate celery?
That's a good question, and a question that I deliberately sidestep in my book.
Because you don't want to offend her, that's fine.
It has to do with perception and preference. And what that's a hornet's nest. So what I wanted to do is just provide a field guide of what's out there. Whether or not you like it is your business. Celery actually has a molecule called sotolon, S-O-T-O-L-O-N, which is generated when celery is cooked in a sofrito or, you know, many of the kind of pre-seasonings that that inform Western European cooking. And it turns out that that molecule is it's found in lots of different things, including fenugreek, including maple syrup.
Mm.
It's a kind of caramel sweet aroma.
Yeah.
That that you don't get from celery when it's raw and crunchy, but if you cook it gently, it provides that that kind of sweet note. And there's a seasoning in Europe, maggi, M-A-G-G-I, which is a soup stock.
Oh God, I love that stuff.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
The relative of celery grown in Europe called lovage, which is like celery on steroids, is actually called maggi kraut in Germany because it develops that aroma of a seasoned broth all by itself. So it's known as there's really no English equivalent. You know, it's taking a brand name and applying it to a plant, where the plant was the first one to to provide that sensation in the first place.
Meaning, if you take lovage and you just cook it by itself,
uh-huh,
in water,
yeah,
it creates a
well. And actually, celery does as well, but lovage much more so, in a much much greater quantity.
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, actually, I love hearing you say this because my wife, who the celery hater, despises the scent of it. Like when I bring it in the house, if I'm cutting it and she smells it, she's like, why did you bring that here? What are you doing to me? But she will eat it when cooked.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if the cooking, you know, breaks down the scent that she doesn't like, the aroma, the flavor she doesn't like. Or maybe she does like the, like you said, that sort of sweet, mapley, fenugreek-y kind of flavor that develops in celery when you cook it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the molecules that give you the kind of classic celery aroma are the ones that get broken down in order to make the sweet, fenugreek-y, maple syrupy aroma. So you're losing the celery and gaining the sweet. And so I think that's exactly why she will tolerate it cooked but can't tolerate it raw.
Oh, that's fascinating. I want to talk a little bit about some of the connections between aromas, like you mentioned almonds and peach pits. I was a little bit blown away when I read in your book that cooked chicken, simply cooked chicken, can smell a little bit inherently like fried chicken, because chicken contains a molecule that's produced when you heat cooking oil. And I don't know even why I remember this, but I do remember at one point eating a potato chip and going, why does this potato chip taste like fried chicken? I was, you know, maybe they had some like, you know, secret seasoning on it or whatever, but it was just a potato chip. And so maybe it was that connection between heated oil and whatever the molecule was in chicken. What are some other like chemical connections across different foods you found that surprised you?
So I have a couple of favorite molecules that tend to pop up in places that you don't necessarily expect them. And one of those is something called methylbutanol. So it's just a small 5-carbon molecule. And it is a key component in the aromas of chocolate and cocoa.
Mm-hmm.
But also soy sauce.
Okay.
And it's also generated in kind of background quantities almost any time you cook a food with protein in it. So any kind of meat or fish or nuts. So it's really prominent in cocoa. And if you smell that molecule all by itself, which I've done, the first thing you think of is cocoa. But then take a sniff next time you use soy sauce. Just take a little bit and take a sip and think cocoa. And I think you'll see the connection. And then that kind of thing in much smaller quantities enriches the aroma of many, many foods that we have. It's also really important, especially in Asian cooking, because it's really dominant in malt syrups and sugars. Mm. Malted barley, for example. So it's broken off of proteins, and so that's why you find it in these materials mostly made from seeds or from animal materials.
Okay. But yeah, because cocoa is made from a seed, right?
And soy sauce from soybeans, but, you know, treated very differently, and yet that same molecule pops up.
And do you feel like that, learning about that, does that help your cooking, or does that help the art of cooking? Does that say to you, okay, what that means is we should be putting cocoa and soy sauce and meat together?
No, it doesn't mean that.
Okay.
No, it's, for me, the value of reading about these kinds of things and at least not necessary to remember any of these names or where things appear. It's just that knowing that they're there, knowing that there are these notes in different foods which get shared across kinds of preparations or even genres of things in the world just sharpens your attention so that you you can be looking for them and not find them, and that's fine. You can be looking for them and find them. You can be not looking for them, and all of a sudden that note pops out of the chord.
Mm-hmm.
And just the same with you and the chickeny note in the potato chip. You're getting a little hint of something real going on there, that there is this shared component in those flavors, and it's for that instant become really evident, and then it's going to go away.
Yeah. There's something so beautiful about that, right? The ephemeral nature of it's just, there's just so much wonder in the world, right? And it's thrilling to know that sometimes that thing you were wondering was in fact there. And even if it is or isn't, just keeping your mind open and keeping your senses open to letting the world reveal itself in these little tiny mysteries is really a great part of living.
Yeah, no, I think it for me anyway, it has added a lot, and not just to food and cooking, but to just going for runs, going to the seashore. Just it's there's a lot going on, and a lot worth paying attention to if you have the bandwidth to do it.
Yeah, I love that. It's a lot of what poetry does too. Thank you so much, Harold. It's been so fun talking with you.
Thank you, Francis. It's been great for me too.
Harold McGee is the author of Nosedive, a field guide to the world's smells. Well, that's our show for this week. We'll be back to answering your cooking questions soon, and with an amazing guest, Ina Garten. So send us your cooking questions. Record them as voice memos on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and keep the people around you safe. We'll talk to you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe to our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. It's at splendidtable.org. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.